Wayne Pond on WCHL, substituting for my good friend D.G. Martin on Who's Talking. And my guest is an old friend. Well, Phil, I haven't seen you in years, but I still feel a real strong connection to you. Phil Richards is a professor of English at Colgate University up in Hamilton, New York. And he is the author of a book called Black Heart. Now, Phil, I have to tell our listeners here in Chapel Hill, I'm sure some of them will remember you from your year at the University of North Carolina. You've got to be one of the sweetest natured guys I've ever met. But this book is pretty, this is pretty in your face. Again, it is called Black Heart, and the subtitle is The Moral Life of Recent American African-American Literature. You make some pretty strong charges in this book, Phil. What do you mean by moral issues in literature? Doesn't that belong in the pulpit and with the preachers rather than the literary critics?
I think that reading is inherently an ethical experience. As we read, we decide to sympathize with or not to sympathize with certain characters. We decide that certain conclusions are plausible or not. And those decisions are often ethical decisions. They turn on the question of what is good or what is the good life. Mm-hmm. And if the books we read aren't challenging enough, then we aren't challenged intellectually enough to reflect on ethical issues in a sufficient way.
So you're talking about morality, maybe not in the sense of angels dancing on the heads of pins and theological questions. You're talking about, in a way, the practicalities of the way we live our lives and how literature interacts with the choices that we make.
Absolutely. I think that reading is an image of day-to-day life in that sense, that when we talk about our children's marriages or their choice of schools or our own private lives, we have to make complicated moral judgments that aren't easy. And one of the great things about really good literature is that it challenges us to make ethical reflection at that level.
Well, now, that sounds like a fairly, not, I don't mean to say harmless, but innocuous and straightforward kind of statement. Nonetheless, in your book, Black Heart, Phil, you argue that there is a crisis in the moral dimension of African-American letters. Now, what do you mean? Who's fighting with whom and what's at stake?
Well, at stake is whether Afro-American critics are engaged enough in this ethical dimension of reading that I'm talking about. I don't think that we're reading texts that challenge us to make the kinds of difficult moral distinctions that we need for a reading that's going to illuminate our political, social, and cultural lives. Mm-hmm. Reading is a school for civic action. It's a school for the way we live our lives in our home. And we need texts that are hard, that are difficult, and that force us to think, that don't yield easy answers.
Well, let's talk by way of example, Phil. We talk about the so-called classics of American writing. I can think of work by Governor Winthrop, or we could look at some of the poems of Emily Dickinson. We could look at Zora Neale Hurston. We could look in the 19th century at Herman Melville or Nathaniel Hawthorne. The Scarlet Letter, for example, is I've always wondered, Phil, why this book gets assigned to high school kids, but that's another story. There's a book that challenges people to think about the moral dimension of life. Is there something analogous to that or insufficiently analogous to that in African-American writing?
Well, I think a book like Invisible Man challenges us to think about what our responses are to the institutions of school, of politics, of family, by which Afro-American life is shaped. We see a character coming to grips with those institutions as they existed in the early 20th century, and we're forced to gauge his response to the Communist Party or gauge his response to the typical black college in ways that make us think about how black life is lived and what its traditions are and how we can live our lives within them.
So you're saying that a book like Invisible Man is not, it falls within the category that you think properly in terms of African-American writing, challenging us to think in moral dimensions. But it is what, the exception rather than the rule when it comes to the kind of thing that we're reading or the kind of thing that is the object of literary criticism?
I don't think that many black critics will disagree that there aren't many Invisible Men in the canon. And that Invisible Man is on a par with Moby Dick or Scarlet Letter or Jonathan Edwards' personal narrative, mm-hmm. in the way in which it refuses to accept easy interpretation, in the way that it challenges us to distinguish our own moral judgments from self-righteousness or from easy ideological answers.
Phil, let me get personal with you for a moment, and we'll create a little sidebar here. Part of what you argue in this book, Black Heart, which is an account of the moral dimension of African-American writing, is indeed very scholarly. It draws on draws strongly on literary history. And yet there is a personal element at work here. You talk about arriving at Yale University in 1968 and finding yourself, you supply the words here, astonished, dismayed. And my point here is that personal experience connects to the argument that you're making in this book. Would you tell us about that?
Well, yes. I came to the university wanting to escape Cleveland, Ohio. And
I've always heard Cleveland's a pretty good place.
Cleveland's a very nice place now. It's really improved in the last 30 years. But like many 18-year-olds in the Midwest, I wanted to go to a large cosmopolitan city or university where, you know, I'd be exposed to what I thought of as the larger world. And the world I encountered was a segregated one. It was one in which blacks were withdrawing many times intellectually and culturally from not just the social life of Yale, but what I thought were the intellectual centers of Yale.
What did you expect, Phil?
I expected vivid interracial interaction around texts that I thought were important. And cultural issues that I thought were important, not just important, but traditionally important. The large issues of Western tradition.
And what did you find in place of this
bonfire? Well, obviously I found many brilliant teachers who had many incredible things to say about literature and history and philosophy. I learned from them. But I also found a certain kind of middle-class black cynicism about so-called Western culture, a perception that this Western culture was in some sense irrelevant to a black experience, which was never clearly defined. And I found also a sustained attempt to read this black experience in a kind of all-black context, to working towards black canons or black history. And I began to see the seeds of what I now think is flourishing in the academic world, which is a kind of tunnel vision in Afro-American studies. And I reacted pretty strongly against.
Well, now, wouldn't it be fair to say that in a way, regardless of how widely or narrowly focused this black reaction that you just described was well earned on the part of black people? Are they deserving?
I think that's a very interesting question, because I think that the right to make critical discriminations is earned by broad reading and reflection. And I think that it's easy to make political and ideological cultural choices which aren't grounded in a sufficient erudition or sufficient sensibility.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's possible to make those choices too quickly. So one of my concerns in the book is that you have to earn the right through the cultivation of a sensibility or the cultivation of erudition to make kinds of moral discriminations I'm talking about. Another way of saying this is that as we read and read and read, we learn to think about what we read better.
Mm-hmm.
And we learn to make choices about what we think is good, what we think is bad, what we think is engaging, and what we think is not.
Phil, we're going to take a break here, and we'll come back in just a few minutes. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Who's Talking? Wayne Pond substituting for my friend D.G. Martin. And my guest is Philip Richards, who is a professor of English at Colgate University and the author of a book called Black Heart, The Moral Life of Recent African-American Literature Letters. It's Who's Talking on WCHL. We'll be right back. Wayne Pond on WCHL, subbing for my friend D.G. Martin on Who's Talking. My guest is Phil Richards, who is a professor of English at Colgate University. Phil has a new book called Black Heart, and the subtitle is The Moral Life of Recent African-American Letters. Phil, we're into the rarefied air here of literary theory and literary canonicity and what people should read and what they shouldn't read. You were talking before the break about what you found and what you expected to find when you went off from Cleveland as to be an undergraduate at Yale University. Let's talk about the other end of the arc of your training as a literary critic, and that would be when you were in graduate school at the University of Chicago. What is it that you studied? What is it that you think you should have studied? What is it that you want to teach now? We're approaching this very large question of what's called the canon and what people should read, and you're interested in it because you think it has a moral dimension.
Well, I came to Chicago from Yale thinking that the English literary tradition was a series of texts going from Old English to the modernist period.
That sounds sensible to me.
And that you had to somehow engage in the central text of the central periods. And so I did a very un-American thing. Americans tend to specialize in particular periods.
Mm-hmm.
But I tried to read as widely as I could in English literature to get a sense of the different periods and the sense of continuities. And I also thought that it was necessary to learn Latin. It's something I didn't really succeed in as well as I wanted to, but I had a very brilliant teacher at Yale named Michael O'Loughlin, who taught a seminar in English literary tradition. It was a year-long seminar that counted as four courses, and O'Loughlin was really a classicist, and he convinced me that a lot of English literature was grounded in the classics, and so I set forth trying to learn Latin.
When you say that this was an un-American thing, does this mean that it was not typical of what other black students were looking at?
No, and this is an important point. I think that one of my teachers told me that, a British person told me that Americans want to specialize in a particular period.
Mm-hmm.
Or two periods that they think are related. And so They tend to bear down on courses that that focus on those periods. And when you see job ads, they advertise for someone in 18th century novel or someone in Middle English. And there's an assumption that you've kind of grounded yourself in the scholarly nexus around those fields, because, of course, the scholarly literature is so massive now in every field. But this British professor said that English schools had at least during his experience in the 50s, a different kind of outlook, that they saw the language as a tradition and that you should see the key works as part of the tradition. And I don't want to claim that I mastered the tradition, but I did acquire that point of view from him. And I met professors who had different attitudes toward what I was doing. One, some people thought I was doing the wrong thing, and another professor whom I admired greatly said, "This is great. You're reading across the board. But that's what you do. You read across the board. You read as much as you can of the tradition, and when you get into a particular period, you read as wide a selection of text as possible within that period."
Mm-hmm.
That's what he called reading across the board.
Well, what I hear lurking as a subtext in what you're saying, Phil, is that you are doing something that many of your contemporary black students were not doing.
And I think some of my contemporary white American students weren't. I think that black studies is the worst victim of American specialization in the academy, because you have a small canon, but you have a professional attitude that says you have to bear down and master this canon in and of itself, and that you end up not reading the text in a broad enough context because you're concerned with being a specialist who has a certain kind of legitimacy as a specialist in the field.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you need broader context in order to establish a field like black studies.
Well, now, at one level, Phil, you could be talking about sort of the niceties of the comparison and contrast in your education as set against some of the other critics, literary historians, English professors, both black and white. At another level, I could say that your criticism of what's going on in what you call the moral dimension of African-American letters is at its worst, I can hear somebody accusing you of being a kind of reverse racist here. Is that too strong?
Well, I think we make a mistake when we identify a literary canon with a racial identity. I think that literary traditions have their own structures, that they consist of their own philological context, their own set of networks between texts, their own themes, which exist apart from literary traditions. That's racial identities. That's one of the reasons I read is to enter a world in which whatever I think about my racial identity, I find it challenged by the complexities of the text I read and the complexities of the traditions I confront. I go to literature because it's larger than myself.
And yet, if you in turn pass that attitude or that mechanism on and you aim it against your contemporaries who also happen to be black and who also happen to be literary critics, this comes off as a criticism and not as a compliment. Have I got this right?
Well, yeah, that's true, but you know, as I said, I think that people who read and study literature are engaged in moral choices, and this is the kind of moral discrimination that literature forces us to make. How broad a context do we want to bring to our understanding of any particular text, and what are the texts that we think are worthy of moral reflection? Those are pretty central questions, because when I teach American literature, I cannot teach every book in American literature in the 13 weeks of my semester. I have to make choices. And the choices I make determine what I'm passing on onto the next generation of people, of doctors and lawyers, but still people who, through a liberal arts education, are want to learn how to think in a sophisticated way about cultural issues.
So that means that as a black professor and a black critic, if you do not include African-Americans, or at least include them to the degree that other people might include them in the courses that you teach, you're going to be criticized for failing, as it were, failing your what, in terms of racial loyalty or identity or ethnic loyalty or identity.
I'm not interested in the racial turf wars in the profession. They seem to me to be a waste of time, and they seem to me to be inherently losing propositions for blacks, because we have the smallest turf, and the smallest turf of significant texts. And the Western tradition has the largest turf. So if this is a racial context, it's an enormously unequal one. It's one in which I don't want to get involved.
Well, you know the old expression, Phil, that academic politics is so vicious because the stakes are so small.
Absolutely.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a quick break here. Wayne Pond substituting for D.G. Martin on WCHL's Who's Talking. My guest is Philip Richards, who is a professor of English at Colgate University and who has a new book called Black Heart, The Moral Life of Recent African-American Letters. Who's Talking on WCHL? We'll be right back. Pond on WCHL, substituting for D.G. Martin, who's talking. My guest is Phil Richards, who has a new book called Black Heart, The Moral Life of Recent African-American Letters. Phil, let's get specific. What do you feel obliged, indeed morally passionate, what do you feel morally passionate about teaching your students? And I want you to cite some examples and tell me why you think they're important.
One text I feel passionate about early in the American Literature Survey is Jonathan Edwards, because
Phil, you mean a dead white guy?
He is dead.
And he was white, wasn't he?
And he was white.
Okay, fair enough.
He was also a very astute student of human psychology.
Well, somebody who is it, Mr. Marston at Notre Dame, says that he was our greatest theologian.
Yeah, he's one of our few systematic thinkers in American literary tradition.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see how we get around him. And one of the reasons that he's so important is that he's not only a top-down theologian who works from grand ideas, but he's concerned with the niceties of personal religious experience. And so he's concerned with when are you doing a godly moral thing, or when are you fooling yourself into thinking that you are? When are your motivations pure, mm-hmm. or when are your motivations coming from being drawn towards the good?
All right, now just a little context here, Phil. This is a man, again, amongst the historians and the philosophers, the historians of religion and literature, who was a giant in American culture, lived in the first part of the 18th century, and yet he was a slave owner, if not holder.
He had a household slave.
Is there a contradiction at work here? You're arguing that he deserves to be taken seriously by black as well as white readers in the 21st century.
Right. Well, it's very interesting because his students were all anti-slavery people, and one of the reasons they were anti-slavery was that they believed in his ideas about benevolence so deeply. They believed in disinterested benevolence, that you should do the good thing without regard to your personal interests. So they attacked slavery on the basis of his thinking that true goodness was something that transcended self-interest.
So, even though he himself did not become an abolitionist, or was not.
Right, we usually think of abolitionists in the 19th century context, but he wasn't. He wasn't anti-slavery, although there are very few real anti-slavery texts. I think he dies in, the 1750s.
Mm-hmm.
Anti-slavery activity really gets underway in the later 18th century, around the time of the American Revolution.
So he's a kind of...
So to a certain extent, the anti-slavery issue hadn't gelled in the ideological way that it would in the last quarter of the century.
But he's a forerunner. He prefigures this kind of thinking.
Right. He prefigures it, and his notions of benevolence are central to not only anti-slavery work, but also reform movements throughout the 19th century.
Okay, so let me stop you, Phil. So for what I hear you saying is that even though he's important because he was white and because he was a slave owner, or if not owner, he had slaves in his household, because of those two enormously important facts, he would not be taken seriously by black critics and historians of America. Is that right?
Well,
and you're saying that he should be.
Yeah, I think that there are sophisticated black literary critics and historians who know American literature and who would take him seriously. Well, let me frame it in another way. I have a young relative at a good school, and he skimmed through the book, and he said, "Well, look, the black kids in my schools would tell you that they read Edwards, they read Emerson, they read Thoreau in high school, and they didn't get a chance to read Frederick Douglass or Richard Wright.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't want to read Edwards or Thoreau in college now because they want to get a handle on their blackness, and that's not connected to their blackness." Literary history has a logic of its own, and the ideas of Edwards are deeply connected to reform movements that benefited blacks, and that's one of the reasons we study history and literature, is to learn those connections which transcend our own racial identifications, or at least the easy racial identifications we make.
Mm-hmm. Let's move to another example. We could talk, forever and ever here about people like Edwards, who indeed is very important. Give me another illustration, Phil, of a writer that you feel belongs in the what shall we call it? Just the canon, regardless of racial issues, and yet who may be controversial. How about that?
Right. I think that Richard Wright is not popular among the deconstructors or the signifiers in black literary studies, those black critics applying postmodernism to black literary works.
And why is that?
I think he's seen as a realist, and that therefore his work is seen as a kind of plodding reflection of real life that isn't as playful and as engaged in parody of tradition and the kinds of literary gestures that these theorists are interested in.
Again, we could spend a lot of time on Mr. Wright, but give me a sense of what you're talking about when you use the term the signifiers and the deconstructionists. We're into some pretty deep water here. Remember, Phil, we're talking to a general audience. These are tough terms to explain.
There's a school of literary theorists who feel that when we read a text, we grasp one of the many possibilities of that text, that it could mean a whole set of different things. And these writers are interested in interpreting texts with an eye to the variety of different things that a given sentence or a good paragraph could mean. And often in their interpretation, they find points in the text which are so full of different possible meanings that they that they become totally ambiguous.
In other words, it means everything because it's circular here. It can mean everything because they find everything to find.
Right, or it can mean nothing.
Yeah, okay.
Because there's an endless possibility of what it could mean. And I think that in writers like Derrida, that kind of interpretation became associated with a kind of playfulness in which the critic delighted in parroting the meanings of given, the accepted meanings of given text, and parroting arguments that appeared to be grounded logically but could actually be teased in order to reveal a bunch of contradictory meanings.
And you, I take it, believe that there is, regardless of the richness or the possibilities, interpretively speaking, you believe that there is such a thing as a writer on the one hand and a critic on the other hand.
Right, and I think the deconstructionists have a good insight that there are a variety of meanings. I would just say that a large part of our moral reading is engaged in choosing which meanings are most likely, and reflecting on the different moral possibilities of the different meanings.
So you don't have a grudge against criticism that is complicated and challenging and difficult.
Absolutely not.
Your argument is with fruitless criticism. The question becomes, where do you draw the line?
Absolutely. When are you going to take the play of meanings simply as play,
uh-huh,
or when are you going to take it as a site for moral discrimination?
Phil, we're going to take another break here and come back for our final segment. Folks, you're listening to Who's Talking on WCHL in Chapel Hill and Carrboro. I'm Wayne Pond, substituting for D.G. Martin. My guest is Philip Richards, who is a professor of English at Colgate University, taught here at Carolina about 10 years ago in our wonderful English department. He is the author of a book called Black Heart, The Moral Life of Recent African-American Letters. WCHL's Who's Talking? We'll be right back. WCHL's Who's Talking? Wayne Pond, substituting for D.G. Martin. My guest is Philip Richards, professor of English at Colgate University. Phil has a new book called Black Heart, The Moral Life of Recent African-American Letters. Phil, let's talk about your students, and let's talk about the parents of your students. You know, you guys live off in your ivory towers, no matter where you are in the academy, and yet what you do in the classroom is very important. You are dealing with these young and tender minds. You are bringing them along. What is your obligation as a teacher and as a critic of literature when it comes to your students?
I think I have an obligation to present them with challenging texts and to engage them in the kind of serious reflection that I'm talking about here. I think that reflection is connected with techniques of close reading and of literary history that are important for them to learn. And so I see the pedagogical process as part technical and as part moral, because I think that's good training in the liberal arts for the kind of thinking people do who have liberal arts education.
And do your students, are they receptive to this high-minded attitude that you just described?
I think that's part of the reason they come to Colgate.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't want to portray myself as unique in any way. I think that most of my colleagues feel that way.
Mm-hmm. How about the parents? It seems to me that professors, of course, they're aware of the fact that their students have parents and that they have families, but they don't always connect with that that notion of reaching through the student to the families. Do you think about things like that, Phil?
Well, yes, I do, because I have a son in college right now, And I had a daughter who went to who graduated from college, and whenever I have a child in college, I think about it all the time.
What kind of experience should these young people be having in their literature classes specifically, and more broadly in their liberal arts education?
Well, I think in a lot of cases it's important to engage the students first, just to get their attention and get their focus on a text, and then secondly to motivate them to explore the text in a literary way. I think once you can do that, then you can talk about some of the techniques and some of the ideas that I'm interested in.
Mm-hmm. I can hear somebody listening to this conversation, Phil, and sympathetic or not to what you're saying, reflecting and saying to himself or herself, what gives you the authority? What's the platform you stand on when you are making pronouncements like this? How about that?
Yes, I think intellectuals have a social role in society, and I think they have an important role in educating civic leaders, because civic leaders have to make decisions about public policy that are often out of the box. And one of the things that literature teaches us to confront are moral situations that are out of the box. That's what a lot of great writers present us with.
Mm-hmm. How about your colleagues? You are a tenured professor, and so you enjoy a certain degree of security. But speak candidly to our listeners, Phil. When people make pronouncements such as you make in this book about the moral dimension of African American letters, how do your colleagues react to that kind of thing?
I think I have a mixed reaction. I think that they're colleagues who are supportive. My book sold pretty well in the Colgate bookstore.
Congratulations.
A literary critical text.
Uh-huh.
You can imagine what that is. But
in the dozens.
Right, in the tens. But you know, I your point's taken. I think that there are people in Black Studies who would say that the reading of Black text is important for the formation of Black identity. It's important for defining certain values that we want to associate with Black culture,
mm-hmm.
and that I'm engaged in a kind of reflection that doesn't fuel those issues, fuel those demands.
Mm-hmm.
Directly, that and I would say to them that they're engaged in a kind of therapy and socialization.
And you're not using those words in a positive sense either. Right?
No, and for which literature is ill-suited.
Uh-huh.
That one of the things that literature teaches us to do is to question our received values about that come with our culture and that come with our race.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we want students to do is to develop independence of mind enough to think analytically about the different definitions of Blackness that they're provided. I think we can often do that by teaching the classics better than by teaching our NIGs.
Now, you say in your book, Phil, that at its harshest level, you say that some of your co-conspirators, as it were, Black literary critics, historians of culture, really have come off as parodies of what they are trying to do. That is very strong. Tell us about that briefly, and how was that criticism received?
Well, one of the interesting things about reading recent text in the Signifier Deconstruction School is that the critics themselves talk about their fear of becoming minstrels, of becoming...
That's a very strong, harsh word.
Black people in white faces.
Yeah.
Or becoming Black images of white people, and engaging in this kind of parodic activity as if the appropriation of Western culture is somehow an inauthentic action for a black person. I think there's a profound anxiety right now about what our relation as black intellectuals is to the text of the canon. And there have been other ethnic groups whose access or purchase on the canon has been questioned in the 30s and 40s, and they rose to the occasion, and they define the canon for themselves.
You might be talking, for example, about Jewish writers of.
Yeah, I'm thinking
is that
of
a
Lionel
good
Trilling and Philip Roth.
Uh huh. Uh huh.
Norman Podhoretz.
So what are we going through?
Howard, Alfred Kisson.
Uh-huh. We're going through a kind of cycle then.
Or Harold Bloom. Yes, I think we are.
Uh-huh.
I think that we're newcomers to the profession.
So are you, do I read that, Phil, to mean that you're essentially optimistic about the future, so to speak, of African-American literature?
Absolutely. I'm partially optimistic. I think a lot of this is engaged with temporary anxieties about status and professional role.
Phil, we're running out of time here. I want to mention one more time your book. See if we can sell a few copies down here in Chapel Hill. That wouldn't hurt. Wayne Pond on Who's Talking, substituting for D.G. Martin. And my guest has been Philip Richards, who is a professor of English at Colgate University. He has a new book called Black Heart, The Moral Life of Recent African-American Letters. Phil was a fellow at the National Humanities Center out in the Research Triangle Park about 10 years ago. That's where I had the pleasure of meeting you, and I have to come back, Phil, to a point that I made earlier. You and I did a couple of radio interviews out there.
Right.
I remember what a sweet-natured, affable, just an altogether good guy you were, and yet I can imagine that this book of yours is evoking a lot of a pretty harsh negative criticism. Are you comfortable with that?
Well, no one has really paid the book much attention, except a few friends and, such as yourself. But if the book does evoke the kind of attention you're talking about, I won't be surprised. I think anyone who makes severe criticism in this atmosphere of professional anxiety is going to be criticized for rocking the boat. I think that's only necessary, but I don't think we can move through this period without a kind of dialogue about what we're doing. And by we, I mean black critics, and I count myself as one.
Well, isn't that fundamental to the role of what a critic does?
Absolutely. I couldn't consider criticism without that role.
Mm-hmm. Phil, it has really been a pleasure to reconnect with you after all these years, even if it is by telephone. I wish you well in your work, and I am very grateful for your taking the time to talk to your Chapel Hill and Carrboro and Hillsboro listeners on WCHL. Philip Richards is a professor of English at Colgate University. His new book is Black Heart, The Moral Life of Recent African-American Letters. Phil, I wish you all the best. Thank you for doing this.
I wish the best to all my friends down there in the Triangle.